I want you all to realize that actually, if it hadn't been for this session, I could have been at home now, sitting down, watching the royal wedding. So I want to thank the people at Dev Days for inviting me so that I don't have to go through that. Oh, okay, well, one wedding in your life is enough. Watching other people. Oh, yeah. Oh, everybody tweet that so my wife can see it. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm going to be talking for about 75 minutes, but it'll seem an awful lot longer. I have got somewhere in here my book of emergency jokes, which has now got an extra page. If the demos go wrong, I shall read you a joke out from here. Yeah, my favorite joke in all the world that everybody knows is a horse walks into a bar and the barman says, "Why the long face?" Which I really like. But I have got other ones which are at least as funny, which I'll save for later. I'm assuming everything's going to work. If it doesn't, then it'll work. I've got plenty of jokes. Jolly good. What you're going to get from me, apart from the wonderful humor, is getting a bit about everything. But before I start, bit of calibration for Rob. Quick straw poll. How many of you like straw? Okay. That wasn't funny. Right, moving on. How many people here are already writing X and A? Okay, a few. How many C-sharp programmers have we got? Excellent. How many Visual Basic programmers have we got? One or two. Okay, that's fine. That's good as well. I'm not going to say anything. VB is now available. XNA now runs in VB. You can get a VB plugin for Studio and write your code in VB should you wish. It's all a class library. It's all the same. It all works, which is nice. What I want to do really is give you a feel for how easy and fun it is to write games for the phone. You can use pretty much everything I'm going to tell you to write games for the PC or the Xbox 360 as well if you wish, because it's the same framework, it's the same way of working. But I'm going to focus on the phone for this. Bit about XNA, and then some phone-specific stuff about orientation and scaling, and then some touch panel information. A little look at a physics engine. One of the things I promised in the keynote was I'd show you how to make something Angry Birds-esque, and I'm going to do that. Basically, once you get the framework I'm going to throw at you, the rest of it's just down to assets and game design. So I would chum up with a couple of good graphic designers and a sound person, and then you'll be away. Although you might have those skills, which is nice. Finally, a bit about the accelerometer, and then Windows Phone Marketplace, and then lunch. Okay? I will not overrun. I want to rush back to see if I can see who can be out of the Abbey. No. Wouldn't it be great if she said no, if she turned him down? That'd be great. No, I'm not going to marry him. No, I've changed my mind. Not worth the hassle. Okay, XNA. XNA stands for nothing. The rule is that XNA stands for XNA is not an acronym, which is kind of one of these programming type jokes that seems to be completely unfunny. So we'll move on. It basically provides a complete framework for writing games in 2D or 3D. And the common behaviors from it run across the PC, the Xbox 360, and the Windows Phone. So it's perfectly possible, and I have done this, to write a single game engine and then deploy it on all three platforms. The only issue you have to worry about is targeting the phone. You have to scale your assets down for two reasons. There's no point in having big textures in memory. It slows the game down. And also, the screen's smaller, and you want the deployed footprint of your game to be smaller as well. But there are ways around that. There are tricks you can play I'll cover in a minute or two. But as far as we're concerned, the hard bit is the game behaviors and all that kind of stuff. And you can run that across all three platforms, no worries. I have done this. Okay. And the other thing which is nice, it's a really well-factored object model. I teach programming to our first-year students, and I use XNA as a really good example of a way in which you can actually deploy a bunch of resources and make things available to users using generics and class hierarchies and interfaces properly. So the guys that made this have really thought about how the game fits together and how the objects work, and that really shows through, and I like that a lot. So it's a nice place to work, and everything is kind of intuitive and makes kind of sense. If you've not written a game before, Or if you're coming from a Silverlight direction, how many folk here are Silverlight developers? Okay, fair enough. You can admit it, I don't mind. No one will judge you. It's Silverlight and forms are all event-driven. Everything in a form or Silverlight app happens because the user has done something, or a network transaction has completed, or something has actually fired off an event, a timer has gone tick, which your program then responds to. Games don't work like that. Games basically have three things that they do. The first thing they do is initialize and load the resources. And so effectively, that's your game loading screen. While that's up, the game's fetching in the textures, the sound samples, the 3D models, the scripts, all the stuff to make the game work. And then once all that's in memory, we then have two things that happen as fast as we possibly can. We have an update process, which takes the game world and moves it on. In a driving game, it gets the speed of the car, and it uses that to move the car along the track. At the same time, it reads the gamepad to read the thumbsticks so it knows how much power or braking you're applying, and it changes the speed accordingly. It checks to see if your car's hit a wall and measures, adds whatever it needs to do that. In a shooting game, we're firing bullets and it's tracking the bullets through the air and seeing what they've hit. So the update behavior is purely concerned with updating the game world. And the draw behavior takes the game world data and renders it as fast as it can. So once the game is active, two things are happening as quickly as the hardware can deliver. One is we're updating the game world, which is the thing the player is existing within. And the second thing is we're drawing it. Now, in an XNA game, that basically boils down to two methods, which are the draw method and the update method. So as far as we're concerned, when you make a brand new empty XNA game, you get four methods you have to fill in. Initialize sets things up, determines the screen size, does a little bit of initialization. Load content fetches all your assets. These are called in sequence when your game fires up, a bit like form loaded on a Windows form. That one and that one get fired, bang, bang. And then 30 times a second on the phone, your update method is called. And as fast as we can go, which is normally 30 times a second again, the draw method gets called. So the idea is you don't have to make any code to call these things. You have to just put the code in that gets run at that time. So when my XNA game is live, every 30th of a second, this method runs. Of course, if it takes more than a 30th of a second to complete, that means your game is now starting to judder and chug. Okay? Now, the rule of the game, literally, is that update must run within 30th of a second, otherwise the game itself slows down. Draw, that could possibly lag. I used to play Need for Speed Most Wanted on the Xbox, great game, but if you had lots of police cars and scenery and you were turning, you'd get down to about 10 hertz or so. It would chug, clunk, clunk. You've all seen this. What's happening there is the draw action is running behind. It's taking longer to render the pictures. And this is really important. The way the car responds to your inputs and what's happening to do with collisions, that's still running at full speed because otherwise the gameplay would be pretty much impossible. So we separate these things out. So update is you should make sure that runs at 30 hertz. Draw, that drops below 30 hertz. The user will notice the game is starting to chug a little bit, but you should still have your game behaving. As far as we're concerned, we just put code in these. And there's telemetry inside XNA, which you can use to find out if your methods are taking longer to run than they should do. But as far as we're concerned, this tick's going to happen. We're fine. If you're in Silverlight land or Windows Form land, you're wondering which parts of the screen to invalidate so you don't have to draw as much of the background, blah, blah, blah. XNA is much, much simpler. We tear down the whole thing and draw it again every time. And the good news is the hardware will do that for us real quick. So an XNA game will effectively draw a brand new scene every time it has to. And this works astonishingly well. And because we have hardware acceleration in here, which does all that work for us anyway, then this is how the game goes, and it's absolutely fine. But it's a bit weird because you're popping code in methods you never call, and then the framework just calls them for you. So if I make a brand new XNA project, then effectively I get empty draw, empty update, empty initialize, and empty load content. And then I just basically drop in the game behaviors. Now, for a reason that I can't adequately explain, a lot of my games involve cheese. I heard some time ago, someone told me, a fellow cheese lover, that all great programmers like cheese. Now, if you're here and you're a programmer and you don't like cheese, then I'm sure you're still very good. Don't worry about this. It's not necessarily a problem. I do tend to write cheese-oriented software. And in this one, here's a question for you. What cheese is made backwards? Anyone know? You guys should know. Most of you are Dutch. What? Edam. Thank you. Okay, right, fine. Well, I'll have a drink while you think about it. So I'm going to take a round piece of cheese. I'm going to roll it round the screen. Now, one of the great things about game development is that actually writing the game is kind of fun. If you try and think of ideas for games, it can be quite tricky. So what I tend to do is I'll fiddle with some code and see what it does. And then, having played with it for a while and determined what I can do and where I can go with this, then I'll take a game idea and I'll freeze it. I'll think, okay, this game is about X. And then I'll effectively implement it on that basis and add everything in that context. So you do a certain amount of doodling with code. And then having done that, you then pull back to what you're really going to make. And then you go off and make it. It's really funny. We at Hull University, where I work, I set some teams of students off to write games under pressure. And we lock them in the department for a day and make them write code. And we put them in groups. And we say, okay, you just had a meeting. How did it go? And the team will say, we just had a fantastic meeting. We've had 10 new ideas for gameplay. Okay, have you solved any implementation problems? No, but we've got 10 more great ideas for gameplay. Okay, you're doomed. It's the teams that go into a meeting and go, okay, we've figured out we can make this move, we can handle these collisions, we can move the background like that. So we've got some stuff going. Now we're going to put on some sound effects, and away we go. Those are the ones that succeed. Throwing ideas at a problem just gives you more stuff to do. Refining it. Programmers are terrible for showing off and feature creep and all that kind of terrible, terrible stuff. What you need to do is actually focus on what the game's about, and then you can build around that. But focus on what Angry Birds is about, knocking things over with explosions and other bits and stuff. That's all. And they've kind of stuck to that. There's no side plot involving money or anything else or whatever. There's nothing going on over and above that. It's about knocking things down. And they've figured that out, and they've built stuff around that. And if you look at any really popular games, you'll find that they're pretty much nailed down to two or three things. So I'm doodling with some code. I'm making cheese that rolls around the screen. Now, when I talk about a game, I talk about a game world. And in this case, my game world is basically going to be two things to start off with. A texture, which is my cheese, and a rectangle, which says whereabouts on the screen it's going to be. In gaming terms, this is a sprite. Okay. Now, I'm working in two dimensions because it's easier. 3D is great fun, but horrid to get started with. If you look at big-selling games on the platforms, a lot of them are fundamentally 2D games. If you're thinking about starting writing games, start in 2D. The third dimension can come along when you need it. If you look at most games, though, they have a 2D gameplay that looks a bit 3D, and they'll do things like parallax scrolling, where stuff that's further away moves more slowly than stuff at the front, and they'll put layers on top to make it look 3D. Again, Angry Birds does this very well. It's a 2D game, but the backgrounds change and slide, so you think, oh, there's depth in the scene. So please, for me, start with 2D, because it's easier. So I have a texture, which is what I'm going to be drawing, and a rectangle which says, here it is. That's where it's going to be on the screen. I go off and get my texture from a PNG image that I made called Edam. Now, this is basically just a thing I knocked up in Photoshop Elements. It's a round texture with a light highlight on it. You'll see it in a second. I then dragged it into my game project, and Studio and XNA take care of the rest. So one of the things you get with XNA, which is really nice, is you get a complete content management system as well. So I can put assets such as sound, textures, 3D models, all that stuff, I can drop into my game project, and the system will then make sure they arrive on the target device in the right form to be used. So I don't have to handle any kind of resource allocation or putting stuff in. It's dead easy. And it works across all the platforms. So when I push the application onto the phone, the zap file, which gets pushed down, has got the assets in there, but I don't have to worry how it works. If I'm serious about development and I have some new game types I want to add to my games, I can write my own custom content importer. As you can see, we're using generics here, so it's gone off and found the Texture 2D importer. I can write my own importer and bring in my own asset designs if I want. I did a word game, which I haven't yet put out, which I had to have a dictionary for. So I wrote a dictionary content importer, which is basically just a whole a method for pushing it out and a method for pulling it back. You plug those in, and so now I can effectively bring in word lists and push out word lists very, very easily. And it's nice to do. Another example of good design, as far as we're concerned, drag your texture in, fetch it into the game, and then assign it to the variable in the game you're going to use. And now I'm going to use a rectangle to draw it. And all I do here is I give the rectangle an X and a Y position, top left-hand corner being 0, 0. And the rectangle also has width and height properties I can get and set, so I can specify how big this thing is. XNA does not care if you draw off the screen. So if you want to, you can have a great big rectangle bigger than the screen and then pan your viewport around it. So if you do want to have a large sort of map and then let the player just see one part of it, that's very easy. Just take X and Y minus, so your rectangle goes around here, and then use the thing as a window onto that. You can also, by changing the width and the height, zoom in and zoom out. So you can have a lot of fun with it. So yeah, I've done things like I've written photo zoom applications and things. If you're writing things like Where's Wally application, where you have to find out where Wally is in the picture, well, this is how you do it. Make a great big picture, and then move the view rectangle around it, and away you go. So that's how we draw with rectangles. We just tell it where it is and how big it is, and off we go. And so now, let's draw some cheese. I didn't think, let's go to work. No, let's draw some cheese. So if I do this, no, that's the zoom thing. I've got my, so I've started my projects. So I'll go into desktop. All the code that I'm going to show you, you can download from my blog. I've got a demos area. All the code you're going to see, you can have the lot. Okay, even Cheeselander. Okay, I am that generous. So you can pull the source code down and do what you like with it. This is the simplest one. This is just drawing cheese. And so if I open this up in Visual Studio, having made an XNA project, you get the tools, by the way, from create.msdn.com. There's a link at the end. And this is the express version of Studio. I think I'm using the simplest one. And so if you look down here in the... so it's an explorer. You'll find I have a content project. Here it is. And there's my edam.png, which is the cheese, which I'm going to be drawing. And if I just make this thing a bit bigger, because I'm having bother seeing this, don't know anybody else. If I go down here, I've got my load content. There's my initialize. Load content. That's where I go and fetch my cheese. And then here is where I basically say, please draw me with this texture and this position and make me white. So run this up. I'll change the target to the actual emulator so we can see it on this screen, and I'll hit go. And what's going to happen now is the system will start the Windows Phone emulator. There it is, which is a complete facsimile of the device, if you like. It does everything that the phone does, sort of. And we're going to fire it up, and oops, okay, my cheese is in the wrong corner. Now, the reason for that is not because I'm incompetent. Thanks for the laugh. It's because when an XNA game wakes up by default, we actually have the thing being played in landscape mode. So the player will be holding the phone, as you can see on the screen now, and then they'd be controlling it and viewing the scene in that way. So 0-0 at the moment is top left-hand corner, and that's where my rectangle is. If I stop the program and and go into here. Actually, I didn't need to do that, but at the moment, my update method is not doing anything, but in a minute or two, we'll actually change the code to make the rectangle move around. I mean, I could do this if I wanted to. I could go cheese draw position.x plus plus. Okay, so each time the update method runs, x gets one bigger, and the nice thing about this now is that we should actually see it running inside the game. So this is fundamentally how games work. So now my cheese is sort of chugging across the screen in a very sort of magical way. Now, if I make that number bigger, it will go faster. But you can see that I'm not calling any methods. I've just put some code into update, which is now updating my game world. So my cheese is chugging, to use a technical term. And it'll go off the screen. XNA doesn't care. It'll do a bit less drawing because there's nothing left to draw. It'll just head off down the screen and into the wall and through into next door. There'll be this blob appearing. That would be so cool if I could do that. But I can't, so we'll move on from there. But I think you can see now that the rule of the game is you get the stuff in, you update the world, and you draw it. And it is as simple as that. There's nothing more to it than that. Okay? So you've seen that work, you've seen some cheese drawn, and all's well with the world. Now, just to return to what I said at the start, we have orientation issues here. By default, the phone wakes up, XNA game starts running, we're playing it in landscape mode with the controls on the right. That's fine, okay? But if you want to, you can change this. There's two things you can do which are very useful. I can say, go for portrait. And what happens now is when the game wakes up, the phone is to be held vertically. Now, your code doesn't need to care. Because the actual orientation is sorted out. If I really want to, and this is worth keeping an eye out for, I can specify the width and height of the screen that I want in pixels. Okay? We'll turn to that in a second. And I can also set a flag to say, please draw me full screen. By default, when a game is built, it uses only a subset of the screen area and leaves space along the top for the user to actually see signal strength and battery life. Now, you don't normally want that to be there. And if the user selects the light background color, it looks rather ugly. So I tend to put these lines into my initialize method. When you change the orientation, then your width and height of screen will actually change. If you want to get control when that happens, you can bind to an event. The phone has an accelerometer built in so it can tell which way up the user is holding it. So if I flip the phone from there to there, I could make my game get the event fired and animate the transition, should I wish to do that. The only thing I will mention, if you do have games that work in both orientations, is the accelerometer only ever works and gives you values in one, which is as if the phone's being held like that in portrait mode. So as far as it's concerned, accelerometer always regards the phone as being held this way up, not that way up. And so it has its X and its Y values locked in that direction. Whereas when you flip the phone like this, of course, the system moves the origin and does all the good stuff. Robert doesn't bother with all that kind of rubbish. Robert just says, I'm going to play in portrait or landscape, nails it there and stays there forever. But there's one other thing I'll mention which is truly, truly wonderful. I like this a lot. In an XNA game, you can say, I want this screen size. Now, if you've written games for the Xbox, you'll know that an Xbox customer can display the thing on an old telly or a plasma TV or anything in between. They can use 1080p, 720p, all kinds of different screen sizes. And so XNA games for PC and Xbox have to live with the fact that they may change the screen they're running on may well be different each time it runs. Different size screen displays and user settings. In the case of Windows Phone, they've kind of nailed this because they've said, we're going to put some hardware in the graphics so that it will scale whatever you put out to fit the screen. So we have a hardware scaler built into the phone which will actually do this for us at no cost to performance. So what that means is that I can make my Windows Phone game 800 by 480, freeze it at that, and it'll work on every single phone they're going to make and any new ones they make as well. If I want a bit more speed, and lots of games do this, I'll halve the resolution. I'll go 400 by 240. And the hardware in the phone will scale that up for me in real time at no cost to my game. So now I'm using a quarter of the memory a quarter of the amount of graphics work. My textures can be quarter-sized as well. And I've got a lovely little performance hike. And the scaling process is done using aliasing, so it looks good. And the user in a fast-moving driving game isn't going to spot it. So it's a really nice way to actually change the size, fix the size, and get good performance. I can show you it in action, because what I can do is go back to my game here and go back to initialize and uncomment some of those lines that you saw earlier. So here, I can say, please make me portrait. The smallest you can go is 200 by 200. And I can say, please go full screen. So now I'm changing the size of my target device, and the hardware will sort it out for me. So now if I deploy this and look at the emulator, it's moving faster now, as you might expect, because pixels, I'm going, go back, come on here. And I'm in a square with black bands around. The reason why the cheese remain the same size is I'm doing a bit of scaling to make the rectangle always a 12th the width of the screen. So that's why the cheese remained the same size. But it moved faster because there's now only 200 pixels across that screen and 200 pixels down. And because it's square, we've actually got some black banding being added as well. So the bottom line, as far as you're concerned, is you can make the game whatever size you like and have the hardware sort it out. And if you find it's running a bit slow at one size, try a smaller one and see if that improves matters. So there you go. That's a nice piece of value added. And you've seen it working. So, yeah, game world. I've already mentioned this. Quick refresh. We have an update and a draw method. And I have a texture. Now, what I want to do in my game, though, because making a... The user is not going to be impressed by, a red dot that moves and disappears. You will not sell many of those. Okay, even on free trial, it's unlikely you get many takers. Want to add a bit more. So, I'm going to have a piece of cheese you can flick around the board, okay? So you can flick your cheese around the place, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do with it later, okay? So, what I do is I start to think in terms of using a texture to hold my texture, a rectangle to position it, and a vector to give the direction of movement, and a friction value to slow things down over time. And I'm going to make a change here, because if I'm using a rectangle, I have to use pixel values, X and Y, which is fine, but it means I can't move less than a pixel in one update cycle. So I can't run at less than one pixel per go. If I use a vector, vectors contain floating point X and Y components. And so what I'm going to do now is change my code a bit and use a vector to position the draw rectangle. And when I come to draw, I'll just do this. I'll get my cheese position X and Y values, and I'll just effectively cast them into integers, having just done the rounding bit. I could use math.round, but I didn't. Should have done, shouldn't I? Anyway, I digress. This will effectively take my rectangle position and place it where the vector tells it to go. And moving into vectors, a vector being a thing which has got an X and a Y component which gives you direction and magnitude, is I can actually manipulate them in my program as first-class variables. So here, my cheese position, when I'm moving my cheese, I'm effectively taking where it is now and adding the speed to it. So this is, if you've ever wondered what a physics model looks like, there's the physics model. The update, this is true, the update goes ping, I add the speed on, then I multiply the speed by the friction. And as long as the friction's less than one, my cheese will slow down. And so this, if you ever wonder how do I put physics in the game? Okay, there's two lines of code that do it. Okay? And it's as simple as that. And because this thing gets called at 30 hertz, it actually behaves like a real thing. It is actually quite realistic, but anyway. In terms of making the cheese move, I have to use gestures, which sounds rude in English, but I'll learn how to make gestures today, Mum. Oh, great, son, that's really useful. We're going to use gesture support that the phone provides as part of the interface software. If you want to, you can take individual touch events and track them. So I can get a touch event when the user's finger hits the panel. I can get a bunch of events when it's moved and another event when it's pulled out. And all these events are uniquely identified. So if I get four of them, which is the minimum that a phone will support, you have at least four, then I will actually get a unique ID for each of those touch points. So Robert wrote a really long-winded flicking thing, which got the first one down, started a clock, ran a time until it was released, and then pulled a vector out and did all the math. Okay, got that working, very pleased with himself, found out there's gesture support built in. There's a lesson there called read the manual. Because I got down as far as reading touch points. I thought, great, I'm sorted, I've done it, I know how to do this. And I wrote the code, and then I wrote the next page. Oh, yeah, and you can read gestures as well. But it depends on what you want to do. If you want to actually get real control, you can make a piano. On my demos page, you get a piano with multi-touch play chords. It all works. If you want to do that, you're basically tracking individual touch events, perhaps. Do vibrato on each key, so you can move the finger down the key to get vibrato. That would work. That's easy to do. And for that, you'd need individual touch event support. But if you want to actually just detect flicking or pinching or tapping, ask for the gestures. Now, the way this works is we say to, well, here are the ones we can have. Tap, double tap, hold, drag, horizontal and vertical, and free drag, pinch and flick. I'm going to use the flick gesture, which is the one that and the cheese will move. And so what I have to do is just say to the touch panel, okay, the gesture I want you to look out for is flick. Now, I can combine these, so I can look for flick and pinch and tap, and I can get different user actions coming along. So I tell the system, these are the ones I want. I do this initialize, so the panel driver now wakes up and starts looking for the things I want to see. And then in my update loop, I basically go, okay, have you got a gesture for me? If so, go and get it. If it's a flick, which is one of my gestures available, then the gesture will expose a delta property, which is a vector, which is effectively how big the flick is, okay, how fast they flick the screen. I take that value and divide it by 100, which seems to give reasonable game pace, than by playtesting, no other way to do it. I just make the cheese speed equal to that. So this is how you flick cheese. There is nothing more to the code than this. I take my gesture, I just make a direction vector straight out of it. And 100, yeah, if you want to have power-ups and things to give your cheese extra power, make this thing a variable. That's a bad piece of design, really, Rob. But I don't like having magic numbers in my programs that mean, 100. That should be something like cheese flick power, which is a great name for a variable. but I put 100 because I was just playing with the code at the time. And so now we can do this. We can actually roll our cheese. So let's go back here. What I'll do is where's the mouse pointer going? Ah, there it is. I've got two pairs of glasses. When you get to my age, you need two pairs of glasses. I've got a pair of coding glasses and a pair of living life glasses. And I'm wearing the living life ones and I can't see the screen. I wear the coding ones and walk out of my office and I can't find my way back. I get home in the corner. It's not quite that bad, but it's close. Again, deploy to the emulator. Here is my update. I'll make it bigger so you can actually see it. That would be nice. So that's there's my physics engine. Take the speed and add it to position and then add some friction. And then having done that, actually get my gesture. And then for some reason, this bit here is not indented very well. But then I take my position value and just place my rectangle. The one piece of code I'll mention before we make this thing run, I've put a bit further down, is I've added bounce behavior. So the cheese will bounce off it. Otherwise, just flick it and disappear, which is, okay, that's good. Oh, I'll pay a dollar for that. there could be a game there where you have to flick all the monsters off the screen as fast as you can, and they're coming in from all sides. So there could be a game there. I don't know. This is what I talk about, doodling code. So this one, basically, it says, if I'm off the left edge, flip the sign of my direction so that the speed X component is always positive. If I'm off the right edge, flip the speed so it's negative, so that the ball will bounce off. And this is my bounce behavior. That's, I guess, the other half of my physics. And it's a lot clearer on my screen, but that doesn't help you at all. So that's the code, that's the bouncing. So now let's just put the code in the phone and see what it does. So into the emitter. I think I'll flick it into the right orientation, which is not that, Rob. Try again. Okay, I'm running in portrait, flick it, and I'm flicking this using the mouse. But it also works on the phone, so bump, and off it goes like that. And that looks like a ball bouncing around the screen, and you have seen all the code. There is no other magic, okay? We can actually have fun with this, because what I can do is, while the program's running, I like doing this bit, I can go in here and put a breakpoint on that line there, and the program will stop, because update's being called at 30 hertz, and so next time it gets called, bang, hit the breakpoint. Fine. Now, point worth making, this will work in the emulator or on the phone. Either way, it works a treat. I can go into immediate mode. Down here, I can get hold of friction, and I can make it 1.01F. Okay? So I've made friction bigger than 1. This is great, because what happens? And so it's made the change. I'm changing variables in a running program, having broken it while it's running. This will do just the same on the phone. So now I'll take the breakpoint away and fire the program up again. Just keep it going. Come on, there's a good computer. There you go. So now, if I flick it, it'll sort of get faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, and eventually it kind of goes nuts. And if you've ever played Super Mario Kart or any of the games where you have these bits of the road where you speed up rather than slow down, like the bits with the arrow, whoosh, you can leap off them. Well, now you know how that works. We just take our friction value for a while, and while we're inside the area of the screen, we just make friction bigger than 1. So the car will speed up. And, of course, it retains its direction, because when I multiply the friction here on the vector, it just goes further that way. So if you want to have special modes where you can hit certain parts of the screen and the cheese will roll quicker, you want to have uphill and downhill, then that's how you do it. You have a bit you have to go up and then go down again. Then you could have a thing where you have to flick the cheese and you have to roll over a lump in the middle and get to a target. That's easy. You can see the code to do that. It's very easy in an XNA game to actually check if two rectangles intersect to see if two things collide. And I can also check to see if one rectangle contains another, so you can see if you actually landed on something. So you've got lots of fun things you can do here just with flicking games. And so anything like that, easy peasy lemons. So you've seen that, it actually worked, which is always good. So now I go back to my presentation. You have seen the cheese roll. So there you go. Cheese roll, there's a play on words that didn't work. if you want to add more cheese, then fine, you can do that. The nice thing about my physics model at the moment is it only has one thing in it, which I'm just moving very simply. If I add two or three things and I want to make like a billiards game or a shuffle puck type game, then maybe I'll have to have things bouncing off things. And you can get a big physics book out of the library and write the code. There is actually quite a nice book called Physics for Game Developers, which you can read if you like. It'll make your ears bleed, but it's okay. It's great to be seen on buses reading, okay? Don't sit on a bus reading anything with the words "for dummies" in the title, okay? Because this kind of brands you. I'm reading a book for dummies. Of course you are, Rob. thanks for that. So you can do that, or you can do what Robert does, which is find the piece of software which does the job and steal it. And so what I've done here is had a look around and found a thing called the Farseer engine, which was written some time ago by a chap. I actually met the chap at Mix, and I shook him by the head. So I was going, oh, I met my hero, the guy that wrote Farseer. Way! He was quite embarrassed. So we'll move on from there. But it's a 2D physics simulator, which is very easy to use and tacks onto the phone very nicely. And I got hold of version 2 of this, and I threw it at our students to write their silly games in. And quite a few of them did quite well. I'll tell you more about that a bit later. But the idea is that I want to have a thing which manages the positions of things and handles the bouncing and the elasticity and all that kind of good stuff. I don't want to write it. I'll use someone else's. If you want to get hold of this, then Farseer is on Coplex, and you can get it down from there. I've used version 2 for my Destruction Golf game because version 3 has not been ported to the phone quite yet. And for me, version 2 does all that I want. And so I've used this. It'll give you a feel for how things work, and then you can move on should you wish to do. If you pull down my sample, and you can get hold of the golf game from the demos site, It's got the physics library already in there, so just pull that down and change the game behaviors to whatever you want. And at that point, you're in business. So I use version 2 for Destruction Golf. What I did was in October last year, I gave all our students two words, Destruction Golf, and said, make me a game in a week. And on Saturday, we'll spend all night in the department writing the code. And 15 teams turned out, and 12 teams finished. One team, our team of best developers, okay, the sharpest students we got, they sat down and said, right, what we need here is a level editor. Okay, so we'll go off and write parts of the editor. Then they came back and found two of the team had Y going down the screen increasing, and two of the team had Y going up the screen increasing. So half of the games, the ball flew up in the air rather than going down, you see. So they had a huge argument about which way Y should go, and then left in disgust. And that was the sharp team, a team of first years who started programming 6 weeks earlier, took my prototype, played with it, made a game, and got a prize. And there's a lesson in there about the way developers' minds work. But I could see these guys in the corridors arguing, X should go across and Y should go down, it's obvious. No, it should go up, right? You guys are doomed. Because Robert's theory is quite simple. Actually, I was in an exam looking over the students. And next to me was a guy from the theology department who was also watching an exam. And his exam was something like Evil 101. And mine was object-oriented programming. And it's quite good. Anyway, I said to the guy, you're in religion, right? You're theology, right? Okay? So as far as being a student on your course is concerned, it must be easy because nothing can be proved. It's all faith. And there's no wrong answers. And the Reverend thought about this for a second. He said, yeah, he said, sure, Rob. He said, that's completely correct. There are no wrong answers, but there's lots and lots of stupid ones. And I thought, absolutely. So if you're in a team and you get to the point where you've found a solution that isn't stupid, then for goodness sake, stop at that point. Don't worry about performance or speed or memory footprint until you've got it going and those turn out to be a problem. So get it working. So once you get to the point where you're beyond stupid, then don't try and look for perfection, because in this business, there's no such thing. But I digress. Anyway, one of our students took my Destruction Golf engine and put it on Marketplace and had 10,000 downloads, which is about 10,000 more than Cheeselanders had. So Farseer, okay. As far as the physics are concerned in Farseer, we have two concepts, body and geometry. And a body is the thing, and the geometry describes its shape. And all we have to do to make our game work is create these and put them in the simulator. And when XNA updates the game, we update our physics world as well. And so all we have to do is at the start, we say, okay, make me a nice new simulator. And this vector here, 0 to 50, gives effectively the value of G. So at the moment, I've got gravity coming down. Y is increasing because Y is at the top and goes down. And so at the moment, I'm playing golf under normal gravity. If I have a headwind or a tailwind, I'll change the value of X so that the ball will actually be blown backwards as it moves. Now, you saw me with my speed value, which is updated. This is basically giving the constant values of G that are going to control what happens. So that means I could have an underwater level and just change that 250 to minus 250 and play golf underwater, trying to hit targets above me or something. Okay? But 250 seems to work. And you can play with it if you like. This is my game universe. This is the first one of the things. This is a shelf. The idea of Destruction Golf is I'm going to knock things off shelves to get my ball to the next level to play through to get to the end of the game. And so these are the things I have to say, what the shelf looks like, the body and the geometry, and then the position inside the shelf where its mass acts. In physics, it's called the center of mass. Okay, and it's the point about which the thing will rotate if Farseer makes it spin. Okay, and so that's the origin. And having got those, I'll set them up. This slide's a bit busy. I apologize for that, but you can see the code in context in my program. Go off and get the shelf. Put the origin slap bang in the middle. So divide the width by height by 2 and the height by 2 and make a new vector which puts it slap bang in the middle. Go off and get me a rectangle body of the appropriate width and a mass of 1. Nail it to the scenery. This is a platform. It will not move. So make it static. Place it somewhere in the scene and then add it. So now I have a shelf I can put my house on. Okay? And when you see the house graphic, I want you all to go, ooh. because it's really good. It took me hours to draw, okay? So once I've got that, I can then give my shell some geometry, which is effectively, I'm going to get an instance and give it a restitution and a friction coefficient. This is how bouncy it is. This is how slippy it is. So I can make my game work on ice for one level and thick grass for another. And I can have balls that are really bouncy and balls that are like made of iron and just land, okay? And so these numbers I can change. And playing with them is fun. This is why you recruit all your family and all your friends as play testers. And the best kind of play tester, to be honest, is someone that's never met you. Because if your mum plays the game, she will love it. Because that's what mothers do, okay? It's nice, okay? If someone you've never met plays it and loves it, that's when you know you're in business. So if you do start making the game, don't get high on your own supply. Look at it. Right, now put it in the hands of someone that's not no reason to like you other than the game you've just given them. Because that's the feedback that's worth it. Because, yeah, mum likes whatever you do, which is nice, and how it should be. But you get proper feedback. Playing with these is fun, and this is why you need playtesters. And this is why you don't tend to put these things in as hardwired numbers, which I've done here just for the example. Okay, so I draw it. This is a draw mechanism. The sprite batch is a thing in XNA which batches up drawing operations to push into the processor. Oh, I've got a message. I'm giving a lecture. How surprising. Yes, okay. Now, I give my sprite batch a bunch of draws, and it then pushes those into the graphics hardware as a big transaction for it to then deal with. So here I'm saying, there's my texture, there's my position. This stuff here you can ignore. Draw it in white. You can draw things in different colors. This effectively changes the light we shine on the object. So if you want things to heat up, you can make that red. And it will actually seem to glow red, or cool down, make it bluer. And then how far it's rotated, where the origin rotation is, and then a few other bits and pieces that you can just copy for now. And then at that point, we now have our shelf on the screen. I'm firing at a target, which is my house. So again, I go off and get my, not my house, that would be silly. I've given it a mass of 3, okay, so that effectively sets how heavy the thing is. And again, you can play with that too. The mass of the shelf doesn't really matter because it's nailed to the wall. The ball, okay, ball is a circle, just a round thing, and I'll give it a texture, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give it a bounciness of 0.3 and 0.5 again. The 50 up here tells you how many facets to draw, because as we all know, things like circles in computers just don't work. You have to approximate somehow. 50 is how many approximations round you've got. For the screen resolution, that works fine. If you make that number smaller, it'll appear more rough around the edges. If you make a value bigger, it'll appear smoother, but now you're losing performance because the engine has to work harder. So 50 works quite nicely for me, as you'll see in a minute or two. So there you go. Now, launching the ball turns out to be really easy because I just go, okay, get the gesture. If it's a flick, I can apply impulses to items in my game, which is basically a kick in a certain direction. And so I get my delta value I was using to set the speed. This time I divide it by 1.5 because of that's a number that worked best in playtesting. And I just hit the ball with this, and the ball then just goes off in that direction. The physics engine kicks in, and everything else happens automagically. And that's all there is to it. The final bit I'll mention before you get to see my, quite frankly, incredible artwork is collisions. If two things hit, I may want to actually respond to that. I may want to have something which deals with that. And so what I have here is an on-collision delegate list on the ball geometry, and I can bind to that with new delegates. So I can say, okay, when you collide, call the ball hits method, and that will then be called if the ball hits anything, okay? And the method looks like this. It's given two geometries, which are the two things that have collided, and it's given a list of the contact points. I can ignore that. If you wanted to do really funky stuff where things bounce around and do width and detect hit points and get extra points for areas of the thing, then fine, go for that. I ignore that. The first thing I do, though, is I check to see if I've actually hit the shelf, because I don't want the ball to go bang if it hits the shelf. And I want to go bang if I've actually hit the house. So if either of my two geometries are the shelf, I ignore it. Otherwise, I play the sound. So I have a flag that says, if the ball sound is active, don't do anything. Otherwise, I say, okay, set the flag, play the sound. And the idea here is that a sound sample in XNA is basically a WAV file, which you've loaded in as content in the way I've just shown you. You bring it in as a sound sample, and you then just load it in content. And once you've got your sound effect loaded, just call the play method, and you hear the bang. And so that's, it is as simple as that. But I don't want lots of bangs if the ball bounces off the house. I want one bang, and that will do it for me. And the final bit I have to do, final bit, I have to call an update method to update the simulator each time XNA updates the game. So this is, I'm telling it how many milliseconds have gone by so it can stay in sync. And I'm giving it like a factor here, which is a number that seems to work, okay? Ronald Roberts' theories about computing is that everybody's, any useful program has a big lump in the middle which no one quite knows what it's for, but they do know if it isn't there, it won't work. It's called a kludge, okay? Any successful working program has a dirty great big kludge in the middle, including one or two of mine, mainly the ones that involve hardware, of which, yeah, that's magic, that is. So that number works, and so now, there's even more added value. You're getting so much stuff. If you play a golf game, the screen is bigger than the viewport. The ball will go off and the camera will pan to follow the ball. Now, I've told you already, it's easy to manipulate this because you can actually have a big rectangle which you could draw the background and slide along. There's a far easier way to do it, and that's actually to transform the entire drawing process. So what I do here is I say, okay, if the ball is getting close to the edge, okay, then I'll make an offset, which will offset my drawing. And then when I do my drawing, I'll make a translation matrix, which has got that offset value in it, to slide my drawing along. Now, the beauty of doing this is that nothing else in my game has to change. I'm still placing things where I'd like to have them, but my drawing is being transformed so that a different part of the screen is being shown. And then when I draw, I tell Sprite Batch, okay, transform the drawing for me using this matrix. So if you want to have a game world, say that the player drinks a magic potion and gets woozy and the game world spins round and shrinks, okay? Sounds really hard to do, no. Just give it that transformation matrix and make one that rotates and scales, and they can fall down the rabbit hole or do what you like, and it's as easy as that. So you just repeat, you animate the matrix. That sounds great, animate the matrix. And oh, I want more of that. And then at that point, the transformation just gets performed by the hardware, not by you. So it's lovely and quick. And so what you can do then is you can add that. If you want to, you can do a second sprite batch, begin and draw some. So your high score table and your lives counter stay the same. And then you just transform the thing behind that in some way. So if you want to draw things that rotate or spin round or shrink or grow or scroll about, very, very easy. And there's my graphic. Look at that. Ooh, four windows. Wow, yes, okay. So I'll show you that. I should have probably held that off until later. So I'll just get rid of this one. And again, I'll give you all the code for this. It's actually already up on robmiles.com. It's called cheese. There is actually no cheese in this, but it's still quite fun. Okay, I called it cheese smash because I was going to fire different bits of cheese. I was going to have like Edam bombs and little bits of... it's quite funny. I did this talk in America and I was saying, it's great. We've got great cheese of the world. We've got the English have got Cheshire and Cheddar, and the Dutch have got Edam, and the French have got Gruyere, and the Americans have got processed. But I digress. So I'll change the target to emulator, and we'll fire this up. And you know how all this works because you've seen it. That might be the right way around. We shall see. So here you go. This is Destruction Golf. If you notice, when it started, the house just fell down onto the shelf because I placed it in the air a little bit above. That's a tip for games. If physics engines start with things touching, all kinds of weird stuff can go down. So the trick is to basically position it a little bit, have it drop into place. And now I can flick my cheese. No, my ball, sorry. That sounds worse. Nailed it! That's all this game does. After a while, the ball will drop off the shelf, dunk, and the game will reset. So there's nothing much to this, but I've never had it go that well first time. But there you go. I said, now what's happened? The ball's gone up. I should really pan the camera up to follow it. That's quite pretty as well, because the ball, there you go, then it comes, and then off the bottom and resets. If I get too carried away and do this, and the ball just goes all the way over there, and I run out of landscape. So the ball's sort of over here somewhere, and we're panning like crazy. But it still works, okay? And eventually the ball will come down and drop below zero. So there's a certain amount of, shall I say, calibration stroke playtesting to go on here. But you can see the fundamentals of what I've done, and it ain't that hard. At this point, really, we're down to game design and assets. There we go. Battery started. So I'll just try one once more for luck. Oh, I'm getting good at this. And if I could just stop it rolling off. Now, one of the things you have to watch with these engines is that because they're using floating point, nothing ever actually stops. It just gets slower and slower and slower and slower and slower. So what I do is I have thresholding. So when the ball gets below a certain speed, it's stopped. And then we flip the game mode. We lock things down. We move it on, whatever we do. But that's, in essence, that description golf. You can pull the code down, you know how it works, and so now any kind of physics game you want to build, you've got the code to do that. If I was getting clever, I'd have several layers of graphics using a bit of transparency or transparent region so I can do parallax scrolling as the ball flies across. You'll never look at Angry Birds the same again, because then you can look at it and go, oh, I know how that works. I mean, the way in which they get the birds tweeting and flapping, that's just drawing repeatedly different animation cells which you're pulling from different parts of a texture. You can do all that in XNet as well. It's all quite easy and nice to work in. And you've seen it go. And so what I will do now is I'll just stop that. And I'll go back to here. And you've seen it go. It worked. Final thing I want to cover in terms of the phone, the accelerometer. This is the thing which gives you orientation. Okay? You can use it to measure. You could write a marketplace app that measured people's car performance. And you put it on the front seat and see how fast. You could do that. But I'm going to use it for orientation. Okay? And the way that it works is that basically if you're holding the phone like this, you can imagine there's a weight hanging down here on a string of unit length. And so if the phone's being held flat in portrait mode, I have an X and a Y of 0 and a Z of minus 1. And as I tip this that way, the Z value will start to decrease and the Y value will start to go down as it moves into a different axis. So you have to get your head around this, but it's not too hard to do. If you get a value of less than 1 or more than 1, it means the user's doing this with it. So you can make a champagne cork bottle shaking type game if you like. I got above about 3 Gs before my nerve failed. I was concerned about losing the phone. oh, it works! So, yeah, don't do that. But if you want to do that kind of thing, it's all very easy to do. The only slight issue is that, remember I said everything in XNA is polled? You just go off and get the numbers from the touch panel or from wherever you want. In the case of the accelerometer, at the moment that's not the case. We have to use the one that's provided by Silverlight, which is in the sensors namespace that you have to go and fetch the library, add the namespace, and then at that point you've got an accelerometer you can create and start running. Now, this will not be giving you new values when you poll it. It'll read the hardware and then fire an event to say, hey, I've got a new reading from the acceleration values, okay? So you have to write some code to deal with that, but all the code is in CheeseLander, and you can steal it from there should you wish to do so. So this is my accelerometer. I make a new one. I bind to the changed event, and I start it running. And so now I've got this thing in the background ticking away, producing new readings. When a new reading is fired, I run in my method. I have a little vector called Excel reading, and I just set the X, Y, and Z values that I get from the arguments to those values. So this is the bit where I fetch the numbers off the accelerometer, and I cache them somewhere for my game to use. I'm doing a bit of locking here because I'm running on separate threads. So I'm running on the update thread, and the accelerometer is running on whatever thread it uses. I don't want to get halfway through reading X and Y and get swapped out before Z's changed. It doesn't actually make a huge difference to gameplay, but I try and do things properly whenever I can. So this is basically just a little bit of locking to stop ourselves from getting things. And to read it, I just do a lock on that same thing. And I set the acceleration equal to the reading from the accelerometer times, and I'm actually using proper variables now called accelerometer power. And for the Y value, because the Y axis goes down from the top for the drawing and up from the bottom for accelerometer, I have to actually flip that, make it minus. And so this is my acceleration of my cheese. And so now I can, the idea of the game, by the way, I should mention is, this is Cheeselander, where you have to land the cheese on the bread by tipping the phone, okay? It's really good. It's in the App Store. You can buy it. It'll cost you 79 pence, and five people have. It's not making me rich. But then again, I don't want to be rich because, what would I do with the money? Buy gadgets. Fair enough. Once you've got this, you can make tipping games. You've seen the mechanics for moving things around and positioning. This is simply another way you can do that, okay? And so I can use these as forces to drive Farseer, but for the purposes of my Cheeselander game, I've made it very simple. It's a very simple physics model, which just is driven by tipping, and here it is. And now we have reached the moment of truth, okay? So I want to change... No, before I do that, I'll actually get the code up, because I could show you it running on the phone, but you wouldn't believe that, or maybe you would. I'll download it, deploy it, and make it go. So, again, all this code is up there. Cheeselander. I've made an icon for it. Look at that artistry. Oh, Coriano. What a guy. If only he could sing as well. He'd be a star. Right. So, this has a few more assets. It has a background. And this is actually worth taking a look at because it's a proper game. It's actually in the marketplace. There are a number of behaviors your game has to have in respect of what happens when the back key is pressed so that the user gets a consistent user interface experience. And this game works correctly in all those respects. If you look at a game, and this is all the stuff that we've kind of seen already. If you look at a game and go a bit further down, games are basically state machines, like everything else in programming, I think, really. And the Cheeselander game has... five different states. I'll make those bigger so you can see them better. Title screen, the playing screen, the pause screen, the won screen, and the lost screen. And so I have an enum that tracks those, and effectively whenever update fires or draw fires, it just contains a switch construction. It could be down here somewhere. And when it's hit, we just do whatever we need to do. So here we go. Bit further down. Come on, Robert, you're getting too exciting. They want to see it running, don't they, Rob? Oh gosh, lots of methods. They're all wonderful though. They've all got meaningful names. Hang on. There's a really, if you get the new add-in for Studio, the new tools, you get like a big view of your code and you can move it. It's great. Wish I'd got that. Not got that. So here we go. Update. Here's my switch. So title, playing, paused, lost, won. And I just call through into methods to actually get the game behaviors on those. So if you had several different states, then add more states. If the gameplay state has more states, then drop those in too. So you can take this code and play with it and do what you like, and good luck. And if you become very rich and famous, then send me a few quid. I could always use a few quid. Although money isn't important to me, the lack of money is. This is my phone. I actually took that picture, which I'm quite... Oh, go, come back. If you can see that, that's the thing in Seattle. If I do that and unlock the phone and then go onto the home screen, there you go. It's important that you unlock the phone before you deploy to it. So now I'm going to hit this. The phone's plugged in. As a developer, you're allowed to unlock up to three physical devices. What's happening now is Studio, you can't see it, but it's building it and deploying it. It's coming down the wire at the top, and in a second or two, or three or four, the actual game will start running on the device, won't you? Yes, you will. That's good. If you do the debugging stuff, there were deployment errors. Ooh, that's good. Really? That's nice to know. The operation return because a timeout pick. Okie dokie. Well, this is my last demo of my trip to Dev Days, and every demo up until now has worked. And I'm thinking, my gosh, I wish I hadn't told them that. So we'll just I'll do what people do in this case. I'll just try it again and see what happens. If that doesn't work, then I'll have to show you it running straight from the phone, which should just go. The reason why Deploy takes a bit of time the first time is it's pushing down all the sound effects and the background graphics and all that stuff as well. So that's probably going to take a little time, but why it's not actually... Oh, it's gone again. Same old timer. Okay, right. So let's unplug that from there. Let's go that away and plug it in here. Ah, dear. There's a very old joke, which I'll probably have to tell you now because there's a chemist and an electrician and a computer scientist in a car, and the car breaks down. And the chemist goes, actually, a lot of the time the problems are to do with the fuel-air mixture. So I think it's a chemical problem. And the electrician goes, ah, no, but most problems in car engines these days are caused by the electronics. And the computer scientist goes, let's all get out and get back in again and see if it works. So I'm going to just try a different... Yeah, I thought you'd like that. Yeah, it's funny because it's true. Well, that hasn't worked. That hasn't worked either. So what I'll have to do is actually show you the one I have prepared earlier, which is... here it is, Cheeselander. Can you see that, Cheeselander? There it is. Okay, so trust me, it works because that's how it got here. If I start it running, the game is presently paused, so I'll press back to resume the gameplay. And I must have lost last time, so I'll press touch screen for a new game. So now I have to tip the screen to land the cheese on the bread. Now, I have a sound effect which is controlled by the tipping amount. If I hit the bread too hard, I lose, okay? Now, the sound effect, one of the nice things you can do in X&A is you can make sound effects repeat, and you can control their pitch and their volume. So what my game does is it takes the magnitude of the tipping vector and uses that to control how loud the sound is and the frequency of it, so that the more I tip the phone... That's full power, full power! And it'll now go bang, because I will now lose, okay? So the name of the game, and I can do this, is to go... Go like that, nice and slowly, slowly. I can't believe I've got over 100 people watching me play this. Amazing. Now, if you want to live that particular dream, then you can buy it on Marketplace. I'm very sorry I couldn't deploy it in the phone, but I did this... last time, and it worked fine, but of course you'd expect me to say that. I think it's basically nature's way of keeping me on my toes. So what I will do is I'll unplug that, and then I'll plug this back in again, and we'll get on to the very last bit so I can get out of the building alive. So, final bit, very quickly. If you start selling apps, you do these through the marketplace. I tell you what, I'll let you see the screen as well. There you go. Programs are sold and deployed over the air via Wi-Fi or 3G, or you can do it via the Zune program, which is your link between the phone and the PC. If you have a consumer device, all the stuff comes through the marketplace onto that device. So it's all gone through the QC process. It's all good stuff. If you sign up to develop, you can unlock your device and deploy your own programs and other people's programs to it, okay? That's how it works. If you want to take your games to market, you have to sign up. It costs you $99 a year, which I think is... I'd pay that money just to be able to write code on my phone. I am that sad. I buy video games and don't play them because I'm trying to make my cheese bounce correctly in a game. It's recreational coding. I like playing with this stuff, so I'd pay that money anyway. If you're a student... Take a look at DreamSpark, because DreamSpark will give you free marketplace membership. And once you've joined it, you can publish applications under your name, which customers can download and pay for. You can give away applications as free. You can make applications have a trial mode, which can then be converted into the real thing from within your application. What happens in the game in trial mode is completely up to you. It's just a flag your program can test. So you could have nag screens, or you could disable higher levels, or allow different bits and pieces, that kind of stuff. That's all possible. And so you've got, you can charge what you like. If you want to, you can only give away up to 100, but that's fair enough. Any more than that, you have to pay more for validation. When you submit it, effectively you push a single file called a ZAP file, which contains your application and all the resources. That gets pushed up to the service, which then goes through it. There's a test they do to check that all the libraries and things behave okay, which is automatic, and then they have a manual check by someone that plays your game and make sure it behaves correctly as well. And you get very, very good detailed reports back if things don't work. And it's rather nice to do that. It's semi-automatic. There's a person involved, and they will say things like, in level 3, when you press the back button, it should do this, and it doesn't. It does this instead. Please fix that. And you fix it, and you go on. I've had applications fail certification, and the main reason why they fail is because Robert hasn't read the guidelines. There's a PDF you can download that tell you how your game should behave or your app should behave. Once you get that correct, they'll just take it, and it'll work fine. But I did something silly and paid the price for that, which is fair enough. Approval takes 3 working days. And turning it round may take less than that. They'll just test the bits it's failed on, not the whole app. And so it's a nice, smooth process, and it works very well. If you sell stuff, you get 70%, which doesn't sound... Well, that's fine, because I'd rather have 70% of something rather than all of nothing. So you do get money back. It's paid to you once you've earned $200. If you're not from the US, then there's a fairly fiddly tax waiver process you have to go through to get the money into your account. But you can submit games and sell games before that process has completed. If you're a student and you use DreamSpark, my advice will be to submit a game or application as soon as you get your marketplace ID, because that's the point at which the VeriSign process starts to run. And so students do that. Everybody else, we have to send them pictures of our passport and bits and pieces so they can prove who we really are and give us our own unique key. Bit of a pain, but it's easy enough, and it all just happens once. And what you go. So in terms of what we've learned, we have a mix of resources which can be used to make compelling games on this platform. We can use touch and acceleration and physics to make the games more interesting. It's easy and it's cheap to publish. And the bottom bullet point, I think, is very important. There has never been a better time to write games. If you're really sharp, you'll get hold of the early Mango tools that are going to be coming out next month and start using augmented reality, the new sensors, the gyro and the compass, and making your games really interesting based on those tech. So when the Mango devices go out into customers' hands later this year, your games work on them and use them straight out of the box. So you should do that. It really is a good time. And I just think it's fun. I'm not really in this for the money, obviously. It's just fun doing this and seeing people playing your games and stuff. It's kind of quite a buzz. The thing that annoys me is they get higher scores than I do, which is life. So what to do next? Okay. Now, I don't know why. I think PowerPoint's making judgments here. My name's really small. Why has it done that? Anyway... It's still worth going to. RobMiles.com is my blog, and on there is all kinds of rubbish. RobMiles.com/demos is where you'll find everything I've shown you today in download, plus a whole bunch of other stuff, the piano program, some stuff that fetches pictures, the source code for my album shower code that basically displays album artwork moving animated across the screen, which is kind of cute. Register. There's these things called the Jumpstart videos, which star myself and Andy Wigley, which we made last year, about phone development, which are kind of fun. And Farseer is there on Coplex. And the bottom one, oh, gosh, that's in white. It says, start writing games and having fun. Okay, so that's where you want to go. It's great. It's just a good place to write code. Don't forget to fill out eval forms. There are some other good sessions you might want to go to. I particularly recommend the one at 1:15, Earning Money with Windows Phone, because there, how you position your phone in the marketplace and deal with customers is absolutely crucial, and it's the thing developers do really badly. So go to that presentation, learn how to make your artwork look good, your application description look good, and your user experience good. Then we have a cloud session at 1450, and fast starting application switching in Pacific at 4:15. But thank you very much for being a splendid audience. If you have any questions, I'll be down at the front for the next few minutes, so feel free to come by and ask them. But thank you very much.